All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's May 12th. We're going to finish up respiratory chapter maybe fairly quickly and then move on to urinary system. And so we have a lecture today and then on Tuesday, and then that's it for the class. All right, so sign-in sheet is going around. I know it's pretty shocking because I don't know what you're going to do with yourselves all summer long. Probably review the textbook because it's good stuff for you to know. All right, so I did ask you right before class, what is the partial pressure of oxygen inside the alveolus, right? And that's really the concentration that's driving oxygen where? Where's that driving oxygen? Into your body, right? Okay, because you need to have a concentration gradient or a partial pressure gradient in order for oxygen to diffuse down its concentration gradient. That's the only way oxygen gets in your body. It's got to be higher outside in the atmosphere than inside, right? So it goes in. All right, so that's a pretty good ballpark figure. As a matter of fact, you don't have to memorize 105. You could probably just round it off and say 100. That would be good enough. All right, so it's 100 millimeters of mercury. And then we're going to flip through a bunch of slides over here and take a look at this little demonstration. Oop, I went one slide too far. All right, we talked about this last time. It just shows the difference in oxygen carrying capacity of plasma, which doesn't have any red blood cells, doesn't have any hemoglobin, compared to whole blood, which does have red blood cells and hemoglobin. And we can see that if we regulate the pressure so that it bubbles through at 100 millimeters of mercury, that's going to be the partial pressure, right, of oxygen in this container right here. But you see that the solubility of oxygen in water or plasma is very, very low. So if we look at the actual content of oxygen in plasma, we see that it is at standard temperature and pressures 0.3 mLs for every 100 mLs of this particular fluid, right? So that's not enough really to keep anybody alive. So through evolution, blood has evolved to carry a lot more oxygen, even at the same partial pressure, which is what, 100 millimeters of mercury. And why is this kind of a handy number? Because that's what we see physiologically right inside the lung. So that's why we pick this particular number. And then if we count up all the oxygen molecules and measure the volume, we see that it is 20 mLs of oxygen for that same volume of blood. So you can see which fluid can carry much more oxygen. Is it plasma or whole blood? Whole blood, all right? Well, so the effect of oxygen dissolving in plasma is negligible. So if we look at 0.3 mLs versus 20 mLs, what is 0.3 as a percentage of 20? It's about 1 or 2%, right? So plasma does carry oxygen, but it's how much compared to everything else, namely red blood cells? It's about 1%. The effect is about 1%, which is what? Not much of a concern, right? That's not really going to help anybody out. All right, so I do want you to know what the carrying capacity, oxygen carrying capacity of plasma is. It's about 1%, just because oxygen does not like to dissolve in fluid. We're going to contrast that with CO2 in just a little bit. All right, so let's flip through a bunch of slides again. Oh, and we get to this slide. This is where we left off. Okay, so here is a table that shows how we can measure the percent a binding of hemoglobin, right? So when hemoglobin binds oxygen, we call that oxyhemoglobin. And if we vary the partial pressure that we bubble through a whole blood mixture, right? So we start here at 100 millimeters of mercury. Why do we start at 100 millimeters of mercury? Again, because that's the maximum physiologic concentration that we find in the lungs, and then start to decrease it. So as the partial pressure of oxygen decreases, right, what happens to the percent saturation of hemoglobin? Or what about the percent oxyhemoglobin? Same thing. Yeah. It starts to go down as well, right? So oxyhemoglobin forms as the partial pressure of oxygen increases. So when you really look at these numbers right here, right, it's really best to plot them out to see what the relationship is, right? It's always good to graph. So here we have arterial blood at about 100 millimeters of mercury, so there's plenty of time for ventilation to take place, right? So the partial pressure inside the alveolus is loading oxygen into the blood. And then the venous blood, we see, is at 40 millimeters of mercury, and of course that makes sense because what do your tissues do? They absorb CO2 and use it up, so you would expect on the venous blood supply the partial pressure of oxygen to be less than on the arterial supply. At least for which circulation? For the systemic circulation, and of course it's going to be opposite when you talk about the pulmonary circulation. All right, but since we're talking about chemical reactions right here, all right, this is true for only certain conditions, and the conditions are a pH of 7.4, which is about what we find in blood, and a temperature of 37. So if the temperature changes or the pH changes, then you would expect this relationship to change a little bit, all right? So we have to look forward to looking at that. But let's plot these numbers out on a graph, all right? So here is a plot of percent oxygen saturation, or oxyhemoglobin formation, versus partial pressure of oxygen, just plain old oxygen. And what's the partial pressure of oxygen in an artery or an alveolus? It's about 100 millimeters of mercury, all right? And then on the venous side, it's 40. And as a matter of fact, this is probably an exam figure. We'll even have to label the axis right here or even know what these two numbers are, all right? And don't forget, this is the partial pressure of oxygen. All right, so here we see it's not just a straight line. It's an S-shaped curve or a sigmoidal-shaped curve. All right, so let's look at the saturation of hemoglobin in arteries, right, which is, what, 100 millimeters of mercury of oxygen. What percent saturation is that? It's almost 100%, right? So as a matter of fact, you could say 100% just to kind of round it off. Oh, you know what? As a matter of fact, maybe it is exactly 100% right there. Okay, I thought 100 was at the solid line. All right, 100%, I like that. All right, so then this blood travels in past the capillary, and the partial pressures of oxygen start to decrease so that by the time you're on the distal end of a capillary, basically the partial pressure drops all the way to 40 millimeters of mercury. All right, so this shows us how much oxygen is really delivered to a tissue as it traverses a capillary. So it enters 100% saturated, and then it leaves with what, maybe 75% saturated? So the difference between these two lines right here actually shows us how much oxygen is delivered to the tissues. All right? And if you look at the amount in terms of a volume, we can see that about 5 mLs of oxygen at standard temperatures and pressure are delivered to the tissue because of the changing of affinity as the partial pressure of oxygen decreases. All right, so you got to be familiar with this thing right here. But we need to look at some other physiologic conditions. Are your tissues always going to be at a pH of 7.4 and always at that standard pressure of, what, 98.6 degrees? It's going to change a little bit, right? It's going to vary within a physiologic range, right? We call that homeostasis. But can you imagine a time when a tissue might become more acidic? When might a muscle become more acidic? When it's exercising, and that's exactly what muscles are for, right? For contraction, and when they start to contract, we'd expect the pH to drop a little bit. What about temperature of a muscle? Should it be constant, or will it change? What's going to change the temperature of a muscle? Exercise once again, right? So what would happen to the temperature? Go up or down with exercise? It's going to go up, right? So let's look at the effect of this binding curve with pH and temperature. Okay, so here we have a table that shows, right, the pH. So we change pH from 7.4, which is normal in blood. Let's make it a little bit more alkaline, 7.6. And then let's make it a little bit more acidic, change it to 7.2. And let's look at the affinity of oxygen to hemoglobin. So let's just say that at 7.4 is normal, right, and that contains about 20 mLs of oxygen, right, for every 100 mLs of blood. Right, and the venous supply is about 14. So again, that kind of just confirms what we saw in the previous graph, that 5 mLs of oxygen are delivered to the tissue under these normal physiologic conditions. All right, but when a muscle starts to exercise, notice that the affinity for oxygen to hemoglobin decreases at this pH, 7.2, which is what, a little bit acidic. All right, so the saturation at 100 millimeters of mercury pressure is still about the same at the physiologic pH. But now let's look at the amount in the venous blood right here. All right, it's less than in the venous blood under normal pH conditions, which means what? That means that when a muscle is exercising and lowering the pH, more oxygen is delivered to that particular tissue. So is that a handy relationship to have? Yeah, because when a muscle is exercising, right, to keep those mitochondria handy, you got to give them more oxygen. All right, so let's put a couple graphs, right? So let's run a whole series of experiments and plot out percent oxygen saturation on hemoglobin versus the partial pressure of oxygen at three different pHs. Normal is what? 7.4, all right? Then 7.2, we see that the graph is shifted. Which way does it look like it's shifted? What hand is this? My left hand. What hand is this? My right hand. Which way is it shifted? It's shifted to the right. Yes, it's shifted to the right. I didn't mean it to be really complicated, but it's shifted to the right. And what happens if in the tissues it becomes more basic? This curve shifts to the left. But under physiologic conditions, when a muscle starts to exercise, it becomes what? More acidic, not more basic. So the oxygen binding curve shifts to the right. All right, so let's take a look at this. Well, in the arterial supply, basically, it's going to be 100% saturated, right? So the percent saturation, whether the pH is 7.4 or 7.2, all right? But in the, so here's at 100 millimeters of mercury, it's still basically 100% saturated, right? But in an exercising muscle, okay, the PO2 decreases to about 40, all right? So let's look at the difference. Right here, can you see that the right shifted curve actually gives up more oxygen in the tissue as it becomes more acidic? All right, so the way that you can look at this very nicely and concisely is whenever the binding curve is shifted to the right, that unloads more oxygen in the tissues. Anything that causes a right shift, what unloads more oxygen to tissue. So if you want to really have to study these curves to see that, that's great. Or if you can memorize that, that will help you out a lot too. Okay. So a right shift unloads oxygen to tissues. A left shift does what? It keeps oxygen bound to hemoglobin. It doesn't release it to tissues. All right. So as the muscle starts to exercise, right, and you see this right shifted curve, then hemoglobin delivers more oxygen to the tissues. All right. There's another compound that can change the binding curve as well. And it is a chemical compound called 2,3-diphosphoglycerate. It's a glycolytic intermediate. It's a part of glycolysis and or a similar compound, very similar to some glycolytic intermediates. Right? When somebody lives at high altitude, there is low partial pressure of oxygen in the air. Could you give me an example of a city where there's going to be a lower partial pressure of oxygen compared to LA, because we're basically at sea level right here. Okay, but where have you traveled where maybe you were even a little bit out of breath because of the altitude? Like travel up in the mountains someplace. So think mountains. Like what would be a good example? Yosemite. Somebody said maybe Banff, did I hear? Is that what I heard? Who? Oh, Mammoth. Yeah, Mammoth, right? Or Denver, right? Or Mexico City. A lot of places. What's another famous place? Grand Canyon. That is a little bit high in altitude. Yeah, especially the North Rim is really high. North Rim, I think, is maybe 6,000 feet, something like that. Yeah, you might be a little bit out of breath there. All right, so your cardiovascular system has trouble delivering oxygen to your tissues because there's just not as much in the air. So there is an adaptation that can take place, right? So with low oxygen, because at high altitude, you have less delivery to tissues because just of the binding of oxygen to hemoglobin. So you have less oxyhemoglobin, right, less saturation. And as a result of that, there's less inhibition of 2,3-DPG production in the cytoplasm. And that means there's an increase in 2,3-DPG that can be measured very easily. And 2,3-DPG interacts with hemoglobin. It lowers the affinity of hemoglobin for oxygen. So which way does that shift the binding curve when you lower the affinity? I suppose you could go back. It shifts it to the right. And when it shifts to the right, what can you tell me about unloading of oxygen into the tissues? More unloading, right? So as 2,3-DPG increases, right, because of this high altitude stress right here, then there's a mechanism that compensates for less oxygen delivery to the tissues because that lowers the affinity of oxygen for hemoglobin. So that increases unloading to the tissues, which does what? Does it add to or subtract from the stimulus? It subtracts from the stimulus. And what kind of feedback loop is that when it subtracts from this, when the response subtracts from the stimulus? That's a nice negative feedback loop, right? Okay, so that's an important metabolic intermediate. So pH causes a right shift, an increase in this compound due to high altitude or low oxygen in the air causes a right shift. And as a matter of fact, we could also plot these same kinds of things out for temperature. And I don't think I have a curve that shows that, but there's a table. All right, so here's a decrease in pH, and there's an increase in 2,3-DPG. When might you have an increase in 2,3-DPG inside the red blood cells? When oxygen concentration in blood goes down, for instance, when you go to high altitude, that's going to cause an increase in 2,3-DPG. What about an increase in temperature? When might that happen in a tissue? Exercise, right? And in each one of these cases, there is a decrease in the affinity of oxygen toward hemoglobin, which shifts the curve which way? To the right, which then increases the oxygen delivery to tissues because it changes the affinity. All right, so one thing maybe that you should remember is the effect of the right shift due to a decrease in pH. We call that the Bohr effect, right? The Bohr effect. And so that increases delivery of oxygen to tissues. Okay, so you got to be a little bit familiar with those oxygen binding curves. Well, here we see, let's change the topic a little bit. Here we see some red blood cells. And what can you tell me about these two different pictures? One looks normal, one looks abnormal. Which one looks normal? The one on the left. Yeah, I see a nice, almost like a donut-shaped cell. There's no organelles in there. Shape of the cell is designed to maximize the surface area to the volume of the cell so that you have nice exchange of oxygen across the membrane right here. The cells on the right over here represent a change in hemoglobin. Right, and don't forget, how many molecules of hemoglobin are there in a red blood cell? About 280 million, right? Completely fills up the cell. This happens when the partial pressure of oxygen decreases in the blood, and this form of hemoglobin, right, sort of changes conformation and it changes the shape of these red blood cells. So instead of being nice and round and flat that can layer and squeeze through small blood vessels, these cells, which have a sickle shape to them, plug up very small blood vessels and capillaries, right? And as a matter of fact, what do you call it when you plug up a blood vessel to the heart? What's that called? Myocardial infarction. That leads to a myocardial infarction or commonly a heart attack, right? What happens when you plug up a blood vessel to the brain? A stroke, right? Or you could say a brain attack if you wanted to in terms of the heart model, right? But in either case, What's the situation? Well, it's a horrible outcome, right? Leads to a lot of pathology and death. So these sickled cells right here, since they plug up blood vessels, guess what they do to different parts of the body? They kill different parts of the body because blood can't get to it, right? So as a matter of fact, there's another thing that happens too. Have you ever had a muscle where blood flow can't get to it? And how did that feel? Like, give me an example. Like when you have a heart attack, okay, it feels terrible. And as a matter of fact, a lot of people just give up when they have a heart attack because the pain is so extreme that if someone were to give them a glimmer of hope of surviving, they probably would, right? But what other kind of muscles get cut off from oxygen, and how does that feel? You know, like when you have a cramp in your arm or leg or something, right? When that muscle turns into a solid and blood can't get into it, what does a cramp feel like? Well, it hurts like hell, right? Okay, so people that have blood that sickles like this, right, and it plugs up blood supply to muscles where? All over their body. Guess what their whole body feels like? Well, it hurts like hell everywhere. Okay, it feels like they're having a heart attack, their muscles are aching, okay, and this disease process is called sickle cell disease. And people with the genetic makeup to have sickle cell disease, it's an inherited trait, all right, when they go into crisis, the whole body feels like it's having a muscle cramp, right? So how do we typically, what can we do for people that feel that kind of intractable pain? What do you do for intractable pain? Well, opiates, right? We would like to take that pain away from somebody. So somebody that goes through sickle cell crisis, right, will be asking for opiates all the time, right, when they're in crisis. And typically, if you know somebody that's asking for opiates all the time, what do you start thinking about? Like drug dependence, right? And things like that. And people that are dependent on drugs, you're a little bit wary of, because you never really know what they're going to do to get their hands on drugs, right, if they're a drug seeker. So that's a different kind of population than a patient that needs opiates for really legitimate reasons, right? So if you ever end up with patients with sickle cell disease, right, you got to make sure that you don't treat them like a drug seeker or somebody that's going to harm you. You got to treat their physiologic condition because they're undergoing a lot of pain. All right, the other thing, of course, you can do for sickle cell disease is transfusions and fluids and things like that. Okay, so just kind of be aware of that. And this is due to what? Abnormality in hemoglobin, just one base pair modification in the gene for hemoglobin that causes this sickling trait. So you might wonder, well, gee whiz, why is it in our population? How come it hasn't been selected against, right, if it's so dangerous to have? Well, there's a disease in the world that kills almost more people than anybody else. And maybe you could argue it kills more people than anything else, but I might argue that dehydration due to diarrhea kills more people than anybody else. But so this would be the second leading cause, and it is malaria. And so this modification of hemoglobin does protect people from the malarial parasite, right? So there is some benefit to people, but as you can see, it causes a lot of pathology as well. Okay, so that's something about oxygen transport and how decreased oxygen concentrations can cause this sickling to take place. Let's consider CO2 transport. Right? Oh, I was going to ask you a question. Besides oxygen, what other gas has to be transported by the blood? Besides oxygen, it is? It is carbon dioxide. Very good. Okay. I won't give any extra credit points for that because I told you the answer ahead of time. All right, so cells are producing CO2, right? And it's going to diffuse down its concentration from inside the cell into the blood and then eventually find its way into the atmosphere. But how is CO2 carried in the blood? Let's just review oxygen. How much oxygen can dissolve in water, basically, or plasma? Very little, right? And a lot can bind to hemoglobin, right? So about 1 or 2% can dissolve and be carried in the fluid. 98% has to be carried by hemoglobin. Now let's look at CO2. When CO2 dissolves in plasma, the amount that moves in here, 10% can just dissolve in fluid. So CO2 is a lot more soluble, 10 times as soluble in water compared to oxygen. So there's a fair amount that just gets transported in the blood, whether it has red blood cells or not. Right, the remaining CO2 can enter a red blood cell, right, because it's permeable to the membrane, and it can combine with hemoglobin, so it's going to bind to hemoglobin at a different site than oxygen and form carbaminohemoglobin. So another 20% is carried in the blood bound to hemoglobin, but that's not nearly as much as oxygen. Remember, 98% of the oxygen is carried by hemoglobin, so now you're at 30%. So how is the remaining 70% carried in your body if the rest can't dissolve in plasma and it can't be carried by hemoglobin? It's got to be transported somehow or another, right? So let's go back to our chemistry a little bit. So we can take CO2 and combine it with a water molecule to form carbonic acid, right? But you need an enzyme. That will happen eventually, right? But if you want to speed up the reaction, what do you need to do? Decrease the activation energy barrier by introducing an enzyme. So here is an enzyme that can speed this reaction up, and then carbonic acid can dissociate into hydrogen ions and bicarbonate. And bicarbonate, you consider that basically a salt, right? And so how much salt can you dissolve in water? Well, more than you can imagine, right? A tremendous amount. So the CO2, right, most of the CO2, well, 70% of it, okay, is transported in the blood as bicarbonate ion, right, due to what chemical reaction? Name the enzyme. What's the enzyme that interconverts CO2 to bicarbonate and in the process producing hydrogen ions? Carbonic anhydrase reaction. And remember, the delta G for this reaction is basically zero, so it can go backwards and forwards depending on the concentration of these various metabolite levels or chemical concentrations right here. And so how would you force this reaction to the right? How would you force it to the right? By increasing the CO2 concentration means that more bicarbonate ion is going to be formed. And how, but I forgot, are you sure that's true? Is that the name of a principle or something? Refresh my memory. What do you call that? Before I believe you. It is what? Law of mass action, or the cool name is Le Chatelier's principle, right? All right, so most of the carbon dioxide is transported in the blood as bicarbonate ion. How is most of the oxygen transported in the blood? Bound to hemoglobin, right? Two totally different mechanisms. All right, so as hydrogen ion is produced, all right, the cell is going to change its electrical properties because hydrogen ion is a cation. So in order to maintain the electrical neutrality of the cell, chloride, which is an anion, has to enter the cell, right? So there are chloride channels, so chloride can enter the cell. We call this the chloride shift, which then maintains the availability of bicarbonate, right? When bicarbonate leaves the cell, a chloride has to enter to keep the electrical properties of the cell the same. All right, so this is in the tissues, right? So tissues are producing CO2. Where else do we have exchange taking place of CO2? How about the aorta? Can exchange take place there? No, because why? Well, it's an artery, and things can't exchange in an artery. What about vena cava? Oh, there's high CO2 in the vena cava. Can exchange take place in the vena cava? No, because exchange never happens in a vein. Where will exchange take place? What's the next area? Capillaries. Well, here's a capillary right here. What kind of capillary is this? How many circulations are there in the body? There's two. What are they? There is systemic and pulmonary. So which circulation is this? This is systemic circulation, right? So here's a systemic capillary. So, okay, now answer the question, where else is exchange taking place? If it's not, we already talked about systemic capillary, then you have to be concerned about the pulmonary capillaries, right? That's the only other place for exchange. So guess what we have on the next slide right here. Here's a capillary. Oh, an alveolus. Oh, what's that? Oh, it sounds like a lung. Maybe we're still in the respiratory chapter, I think. Okay. So, yeah, here's an alveolus. Okay, and CO2 in air is what? Almost zero. Right? So there's a huge concentration gradient drawing CO2 into the air in this alveolus right here. And as the concentration of CO2 decreases in plasma, right, that's going to shift the carbonic anhydrase reaction in these red blood cells. All right, so now there's a gradient between CO2 in this red blood cell and plasma. And what happens to the bicarbonate reaction when you decrease the concentration of CO2 inside the cell? It shifts back to the left, right? So bicarbonate now, it reforms to form carbonic anhydrase, and then carbonic anhydrase dissociates to make CO2 in water, and now CO2 can diffuse into the plasma and then furthermore diffuse into the alveolus so that you can breathe it out of your body. All right, and then there's the reverse chloride shift right here as bicarbonate moves from plasma into this red blood cell because you don't have carbonic anhydrase really floating around in the blood. It's inside these cells. All right, so this shows you the whole mechanism. And as a matter of fact, as CO2 decreases in these cells, then you have unbinding of CO2 from hemoglobin, which is what, carbaminohemoglobin. That just forms regular hemoglobin and CO2, and then CO2 diffuses into the alveolus right here. All right, so in the systemic circulation, this is the scheme that you should be aware of. In the pulmonary circulation, this is the scheme that you should be aware of. And these are probably two exam figures. At least I hope I remembered to put them in as exam figures. Okay? All right, but it shouldn't be a real surprise because you know Le Chatelier's principle and the carbonic anhydrase reaction. All right, so two different mechanisms for transport for those two important respiratory gases. Yeah, way in the back. Yeah? I could only guess. I could only guess. I can't say that I've actually looked at a slide of thalassemia. All right, so I probably shouldn't answer that, but I would say yes. That would be my guess.
It is a malarial thing
for the
Mediterranean.
Right.
Now, the other question is, as far as pain management.
Oh, okay.
Will they suffer the same pain as the sickle cell anemia patient?
I don't have any direct experience. My guess would be yes. Yeah. Because these cells just can't flow through blood vessels normally like these nice smooth ones right here. They plug up small blood vessels. So you get infarcts everywhere in your body. So when somebody has sickle cell disease and possibly that thalassemia, you get micro infarcts in your heart, which kills your heart. You get micro infarcts in your retina, which can cause blindness. You get micro infarcts in your kidneys, which causes kidney failure. So it's just a tremendously terrible disease to have. Okay, and it's just inherited. There's really not much you can do about it. So maybe there will be some hope with genetic medicine, maybe at some point in time, to cure these people. Some things have been tried. One thing that has been tried was to kill all of their red bone marrow, which will kill all of the genetic basis for making red blood cells, and then get a bone marrow transplant from a normal person, maybe a family member that does not have that sickle cell trait. Okay, but usually the way that we treat this disease is by transfusion, repeated transfusion. They're so immunocompromised, they're so sensitive to other blood products that it's difficult to give them a bone marrow transplant. So it's just tough to treat. Okay. Yeah. All right, so that's the respiratory chapter. I'm going to put that away. And so we're going to move on to urinary system. Okay, functions of the urinary system. Well, you might just automatically think, well, the function of the kidney is to produce urine. All right, but you've got to be aware that it does a lot more. In the process of producing urine, it regulates acid-base balance in your body and electrolytes in your body, and it regulates fluid inside your body, which then controls blood volume. And what does blood volume control? Because of Frank Starling's law, it helps regulate contractility of the heart, which then relates to blood pressure, right? So the kidney is helping maintain blood pressure, especially in the long term. So these are all really important things, right? So to regulate plasma and interstitial fluid by the formation of urine. So when you produce urine, it is not exactly the same from day to day, moment to moment. It could be a large volume that's very dilute, which contains hardly any salts, mostly water, or it could be regulated so that it's a very small amount of fluid, highly concentrated in salt, and then anywhere in between. Right? And so that's just a way of controlling blood volume, which then controls blood pressure. Right? We can get rid of waste products from the plasma, like especially nitrogenous compounds from amino acid or protein metabolism. Right? We'll form ammonia. And then ammonia will be converted into urea in the liver, and the kidneys can excrete a urea, which is toxic and thereby reduces ammonia in the blood, and that's extremely toxic in our bodies. Right? The kidney also regulates the concentrations of sodium and potassium. Right? What are these things good for? Well, yeah, action potentials, membrane potentials, right? And bicarbonate, we see that that has to do with respiration as well. And bicarbonate is involved with pH regulation because of the carbonic anhydrase reaction. All right, so I'm not going to go over these things because this is just anatomy. So if you got to drag your anatomy out and remember what these structures are, right, and know that the kidney, right, the cortex and the medulla, and all the different structures inside the kidney, like pyramids and columns. And then I have to ask you a question. What's the structural and functional unit of life? Ha ha ha, tricked you. It's a cell, right? So always try to think in terms of structural and functional units, like what's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells? It's a synapse, yeah. And for contraction, it's the sarcomere. So you learned a lot of these things. So we're going to learn another one today, and that is the structural and functional unit of urine formation is the nephron, right? So here I see a nephron right here, so you should be able to draw a nephron out. Micturition reflex. Oh, I think you can read this on your own. I'm not going to go over that. But the microscopic function, right? Just make sure you review all that stuff so that it makes sense. Now this, I'm not sure. I want to just skip over because I'm not sure if you can remember it. And you got to know this really well. The structure of the nephron. All right, so it's a functional unit of the kidney. And for every kidney, there's more than a million of these things, right? So you don't have like hundreds of millions, but nonetheless, they're still microscopic. You can't really see them with your naked eye. All right, so let's draw some of these things out. What are the two main components of a nephron? All right, so we got a nephron right here. Should I turn the light on? Can people in the back see that? So we try, is this better or worse like that? Maybe a little bit better back there. So what are the two main parts of a nephron? You've got some vessels in there, okay? And there's two kinds of vessels. What are the two kinds of vessels? Okay, I don't hear that I'm getting a lot of help, so maybe we should just jot this down really fast. All right, so the first kind of vessel is what we're going to call a tubular element. All right, so it's what we call an element, tubular element. And what's another kind of vessel that you have in a nephron? It's a glomerulus. It would be an example of this kind of element. What do you have in a glomerulus? Anybody remember what goes through a glomerulus? It's a blood. It's a capillary. So blood is going through a glomerulus. So the other component of a nephron is what I call a vascular element. So these are the two kinds of elements that make up a kidney. All right, so let's write all of these different elements out, but trace them in the correct order. So if you had some fluid, like we said, what was the fluid in a vascular element? It's going to be blood, right? So if you're going to trace a drop of blood through a nephron, what's the first structure it would go to? What's the next structure? We're going to write that down. All right, and in the tubular element, what kind of fluid is in a tubular element? Can't be blood, because then it would be a vascular element. Okay, so what's in a tubular element? Anybody remember? We have something called filtrate, and then eventually as this filtrate traverses these tubular elements, it becomes urine. Okay, so these are two kinds of fluids that you might find in a tubular element. So the first tubular element is something we call Bowman's capsule. Bowman's capsule, and so what's the fluid inside Bowman's capsule? It is filtrate. Okay, so the question is, after Bowman's capsule, where does filtrate go? What's the next element? Not quite a capillary, because what's in a capillary? Blood. So these don't mix necessarily. They might exchange if there is a capillary there. Bowman's capsule, then it goes into the proximal, and it's a tube, but is it a straight tube or what? It's going to be a lot of twists and turns, so it's a convoluted tube. Proximal convoluted tubule. And then where does this fluid go? What's the fluid again? Filtrate. Okay, where does it go next? Loop of Henle. Okay, and the loop of Henle, so these things are up in the cortex of the kidney. The loop of Henle goes down into the medulla and comes back up. And so the loop of Henle has got two parts to it. You've got the part that goes down into the medulla that's called what? The descending, okay, loop of Henle or limb of Henle, either way you go. And then it comes back up into the cortex, and so we call that the ascending loop of Henle. And then what is this material in here again? Filtrate. Where does filtrate go next? A straight tube or a twisty tube? Another curved tube. And what's a curved tube called? Convoluted. Right? So this is the distal convoluted tubule. Oh, I almost didn't give myself enough room, but we're almost done. All right, then after the distal convoluted tubule, there's one tube left before it empties into a calyx. That's called a collecting duct, right? And the collecting ducts all kind of line up, right? So that's what gives these pyramids their characteristic shape of these different rays coming out, right? So then we've got collecting duct right here. All right, so these are just the structures. All right, what about vascular elements? They contain blood, okay, and there are blood vessels that the arcuate arteries kind of arch over the base of the pyramids here, and then there are some arteries that poke up into the cortex. Those are called the cortical radiate arteries, all right? And the cortical radiate arteries have branches that start to feed a nephron. So what are those, what is a blood vessel that feeds a capillary called? You could say an artery, but an artery is too big. How about arteriole? Okay, an arteriole. So the first blood vessel that's bringing blood into a nephron is called the, afferent, what? Arteriole. Afferent arteriole. And so this is going to feed what kind of structure? An arteriole brings blood to a capillary. But this capillary is kind of strange. It looks like a meatball. It looks like they're a ball of spaghetti. It's round and it's all wrapped around itself. It's called the glomerulus. All right, the glomerulus. But the glomerulus is really what? A capillary. All right, so I'm going to put in parentheses right here. Capillary. And what's the function of a capillary? Exchange. All right, so let's put that in there because this is a physiology class. All right, now this circulation is kind of strange because the typical circulation, you have an artery bringing blood to a capillary and then it goes back to the heart via a vein. But every once in a while in the body, you have two capillary beds back to back. What do you call that special circulation? That's a portal circulation, right? And here is another example of a portal circulation. So after the glomerulus, blood doesn't go back into a vein. It's going to go into another capillary, and what kind of vessel supplies blood to a capillary? An arteriole. So here's another arteriole, and this one we're going to call the efferent arteriole. And since that feeds a capillary, there's going to be capillaries that surround all these tubes right here. And so in anatomy, what do we call, what's the word for surrounding something? Like the membrane that surrounds a bone is called what? The periosteum. Perimysium surrounds a muscle. So peri means surrounding. All right, so peri what? Peritubular capillary. Peritubular. All right, what's the function of a peritubular capillary? Exchange. All right, so I'm going to abbreviate peritubular capillary, but again, it is for exchange. All right, so these are the structures that you should know about, but you should also have a picture in your mind. It will really help you understand renal physiology if you have that picture. So let's draw that picture. You should be able to draw this picture in about a minute, okay? Maybe 30 seconds with a couple of cups of coffee. All right, so where do you want to start? I think I always like to start with these tubular elements right here, all right, to draw it out. Okay, so, Okay, I guess I can get away with it right here. So Bowman's capsule just kind of looks like this. All right, and what's the fluid inside Bowman's capsule? Filtrate, and then that filtrate is going to move into which tube? The proximal convoluted tubule, and then it's going to move down into the medulla of the kidney, and that's via the what? The descending loop of Henle. So filtrate moves down like that, and then it comes back up. Come on, blue, keep working. So this is the ascending loop of Henle. I got a bad feeling about this marker. What about this marker? Okay. Ascending loop of Henle. Oh, that's nice. Then what do we got right here? A straight tube or what? Another convoluted tubule, but this one is not the proximal. This is the distal convoluted tubule. And then where does it go? Into the collecting duct, right? And then off out of the tip of a renal pyramid. So here is collecting duct. And in the collecting duct, we're going to say that this filtrate now has been processed, so it's not filtrate anymore. It's actually what? It's actually urine. But it still can be processed a little bit. So I don't want you to say no processing takes place in the collecting duct, but we can consider this urine, and that's going to be excreted. All right, so what did we just get done drawing on the board? The tubular elements. All right, now what about the vascular elements? You got the afferent arteriole feeding this network of capillaries right here. That's the glomerulus. And then whatever doesn't get filtered gets back into this arteriole, which is the efferent arteriole, which feeds what? a capillary which surrounds all of these tubes right here. Okay, so here is a capillary network that surrounds all of these tubes, and these are what we call what? The peritubular capillaries, and after these peritubular capillaries, right, it goes to a venule and then out the renal vein, right? So you could just say two renal vein, that's fine. All right, so what's the function of this red network right here?
Exchange.
What's the function of this network right here? Exchange, right. All right, so how do you get from plasma that's in blood, or the fluid that's in blood, to urine right here? You need some processes. And there's, fortunately, there's only three processes that we have to be concerned about that make urine. So the first process, okay, the first process is what we call tubular filtration. And so you should know where that is. It has to do with the glomerulus. The glomerulus is a fenestrated capillary, which means that it has holes in it, so it's very leaky. All right, so small molecules move by pressure, high pressure in the blood to low pressure inside the glomerulus. All right, so that's just the filtration function. Probably you all filtered something today. What did you filter today?
Coffee,
right? So you took some water and some coffee grounds, right, and you mixed it all together. And unless you're French, you separated the coffee grounds from the coffee and then you drank the coffee. Okay, but if you're French, what do? Well, you just drink everything, right? And you kind of chew the coffee grounds. That gives you a really good boost, so I can understand why they might do that. Okay, but filtration just separates molecules based on size. Large molecules get stuck in the blood. All small molecules can leak out. Like, what are some examples of small molecules that can leak out through these fenestrated capillaries? How about H2O? And sodium? And what else? Glucose. This is plenty small enough to do that. Okay, and so all of these, now, are these beneficial for you or harmful for you, typically? So these are actually really good molecules to have inside your body, but if they get filtered, where are they going to eventually end up? In the urine. Okay, so that might concern you a little bit. But some other small molecules that are toxic, like for instance, urea, gets filtered out, and where does it go? In the urine. That's a good thing. All right, so the process of filtration can't select for you the beneficial molecules from the harmful molecules. They're all treated exactly the same way. All right, so you have molecules that start in the blood right here and end up where? In the filtrate. And so that is process number one, which is what we call tubular filtration. All right, so we've lost a lot of water right here. We'll talk about the processes in particular in a little bit. Okay, so since you've lost so much water by this filtration process, if you were to lose that water, you could dehydrate in just a matter of minutes, because you filter about 45 gallons of water a day through the kidneys. Right, so just in a matter of minutes, you would run out of water. So to prevent you from dehydrating, guess what the rest of the nephron has to do? It has to take this water back in and put it into the blood, which is the second process right here. All right, number two. This is what we call tubular reabsorption. And it's tubular because it's stuff that's stuck in the kidney tubules. So where is that? So there is stuff in the kidney tubule right here, and so I'll just pick this loop of Henle, but you could pick the PCT or distal convoluted tubule. And where does it go? Let's just say this is water. That will be lost in urine formation, but it's going to be reabsorbed, so it's going to go back into the blood. So this is what? Process number two right here. What are some other molecules? Oh, how about potassium? You need that. Sodium. Yeah, what about glucose? Should you be losing glucose in the urine? No, that's an important energy molecule, right? So that would be like going to the gas station, filling your gas tank with gas, and then taking a nail and putting a hole in the gas tank, right? And then let the gasoline run out on the ground. Don't want to do that. So that's number two, tubular reabsorption. All right, this process of filtration does not take all of the urea that's in blood. Okay, only a certain part of it. Some of urea stays in the blood and in these peritubular capillaries, but you don't want it in your body. So there are mechanisms to take urea from blood right here and put it in the filtrate. And then where does it end up? Like urea. Then you excrete it in urine, right? So notice that process number two is what? Exactly opposite compared to this last process. And so what do we call that one? That is, and it's tubular again. Tubular what? That is secretion. All right, so make sure that you know these processes really, really well. And know where a molecule starts for these processes and where it ends up. So where does a molecule start for tubular filtration? Where does it start? What fluid? Okay, you got two possible fluids. You got what? Blood and filtrate. So for tubular filtration, where does it start? In the blood or filtrate? It starts in the blood. It starts in the blood. Okay. This is really important stuff to know. Blood, and where does it go? It goes into the filtrate. Yeah. Goes into the filtrate. Now, what about tubular reabsorption? Where does a molecule start and where does it end up? For reabsorption, it starts in filtrate, and where does it end up? Blood. Okay, and then for tubular secretion, where does it start? It starts back again in the blood, and it ends up where? Filtrate. All right, okay, we took a lot of time doing that. So you should be able to do this, like I said, in about a minute. Practice it so that you can get it down and draw that in a minute. Maybe at the beginning of the next class, someone can come up and we'll time you just for fun. All right, so look, here are the three processes. Glomerular filtration is the same thing as what I put down there, tubular filtration. You know what? Glomerular filtration is probably a better term. But don't forget the R right there. But at least I'll know what you're talking about. All right, so here are all of the different structures that we're talking about. The tubular elements are right here. Vascular elements are right here. Okay, so here is a pretty nice diagram of a nephron. This is much better than the one that was in your anatomy book. It's pretty nice. I think in Blackboard I gave you a drag and drop exercise or a hover exercise to practice labeling these things. All right, nephron tubules we went over. Oh, one thing that we didn't go over, sometimes we use this terminology. All right, so here we see an afferent arteriole bringing blood into the glomerulus. Right, and the glomerulus is contained within the Bowman's capsule, right? And sometimes we talk about the combined structure of the glomerulus inside Bowman's capsule as being an entity, and then we would call that the renal corpuscle. Right, so the renal corpuscle is Bowman's capsule with glomerulus inside of it, both of those elements together. All right, and it's the site of what? Filtration. Okay, this other slide is kind of nice because we see that there are basically two kinds of nephron in the kidney. This one right here exists mostly in the cortex, right? This is the line that separates the cortex up over here from the medulla, right? So these are the arcuate arteries and veins. See, the loop of Henle deviates just ever so slightly down into the medulla. This is what we call a cortical nephron, and then we have one over here where the loop of Henle goes way down into the medulla of the kidney, and then it comes back up to the cortex for the distal convoluted segment. These two have two different functions. The cortical nephrons are operating all the time. They can produce quantities of very dilute urine, right, which can contain a lot of urea, right? But this is the only kind of nephron, namely the juxtamedullary nephron, can make a small volume of concentrated urine, which is difficult to do. And we're not going to talk about really how that happens, but you should at least know that this juxtamedullary nephron can excrete a lot of solute in a very small volume of fluid, thereby saving the body a lot of water. Okay. All right, proximal convoluted tubule, you know where that is. Contains walls that are just a single layer of cuboidal cells with a lot of microvilli. What's the function of these microvilli right here? It increases the surface area. When you say surface area, you should think of what? A doorway for exchange. Right? So The proximal convoluted tubule is important for reabsorption of salt and water and other molecules needed by the body, all right, because otherwise they're going to end up in urine. All right, so these, I think I talked about this slide already. Indeed. All right, glomerular filtration. All right, these glomerular capillaries filter blood, and these, remember the three kinds of capillaries? You've got continuous and fenestrated, and then sinusoids in the order of leakiness. So these fenestrated are pretty leaky because they have windows or pores, which we call fenestrations, within the endothelial cells, and they even have large gaps between the endothelial cells of that capillary. So these spaces are big enough to allow all small molecules to pass through. Right? Even some proteins can pass through these pores, but not cells. So red blood cells and white blood cells should never enter the filtrate right here, right? Because that membrane is too small. And a fenestrated capillary, you see, is what, hundreds of times more permeable than a regular continuous capillary. All right, so here is the renal corpuscle. And a model in your mind of this renal corpuscle that you should use is that of a serous membrane. How many parts does a serous membrane have? It's got three parts. What are those three parts? It's got the visceral part that's right on top of the visceral organ, all right, and that's continuous. It folds over. That membrane lines the body cavity that it's in. We call that the parietal part. And then there is what between the visceral and parietal membranes? You got serous fluid between them, right? So think of these glomerulus right here as like your hand, and the glomerulus is like a balloon, and then stick your hand inside a balloon, and then you got the one surface area of the balloon covering your hands, and then you got the outside of the balloon right here. So here's the outside of the balloon. This is what? The parietal part of the Bowman's capsule, and the visceral part is right here, covering the capillaries. These right here are what we call podocytes, because they have these little foot processes sticking out of them with these little convolutions, and there's big spaces between these convolutions. So this is a nice cross-section of the filtration membrane. So you have a fenestrated capillary with a lot of pores. You've got a basement membrane that attaches it to these podocytes, which have big holes between the cells. Right, so we call these slit diaphragms. So material, small molecules can move through the fenestrations, diffuse through the connective tissue basement membrane and through these slit diaphragms right here. And when they move through this, where do they end up? They end up in Bowman's capsule right here. So Bowman's capsule is analogous to the serous cavity of a serous membrane. All right, and then because there's a slight bit of pressure in Bowman's capsule, that filtrate will start to move through the rest of the tubular system, like the proximal convoluted tubule. All right, so plasma proteins mostly don't move through that filtration membrane because they're too big, but also because there is a little interaction of charge. The slit diaphragms are lined with negative charges, and the proteins have a negative charge on them as well. So what happens to like charges? They repel each other. So proteins typically don't go across, but some do, but they can be reabsorbed. Albumins normally are completely resorbed so that in urine you don't have any protein whatsoever if it is a normal healthy nephron. It's just a nice electron micrograph of what the visceral membrane. And here's another electron micrograph, but this is a different kind of electron micrograph. All right, so here is Bowman's capsule. Here's the proximal convoluted tubule. You got afferent arteriole bringing in small molecules, which are these purple ones. It says purple. That's good. And then you get the big molecules, which are green, which can't go through the filtration membrane because they're too big. Okay, so you end up with all small molecules right here. So what's this process which moves these small molecules from high pressure inside the glomerulus to low pressure inside Bowman's capsule? That's filtration, right? So that's the process. And you could say glomerular filtration. That's good. Okay. All right, so glomerular filtration rate is just the rate of the volume of filtrate that's produced by both kidneys per minute, right here, which averages about 150 mL per minute in women, a little bit more in men, which totals about 45 gallons a day. All right, so your kidneys are doing a tremendous job getting rid and processing your blood, getting rid of toxins and doing all those other things that we said. All right, so what would happen to you if you were to lose 45 gallons a day of fluid? Well, you would dehydrate in just a matter of minutes, right? All right, so that's what happens with filtration. All right, so most filtered water must be resorbed, right? Or you would die in just a couple of minutes if it didn't get resorbed. All right, so it's glomerular filtration. Let's talk about how it's controlled, because this is the way that your body is what? Cleansed of a lot of toxic compounds. It's controlled a couple different ways. One is intrinsic and the other is extrinsic. So intrinsic means that it's just a property of the how the kidney is made all by itself. Extrinsic means that regulation requires other things outside the kidney, like a nervous system or endocrine system. That's an extrinsic control mechanism. All right, so intrinsic, since it's just a property of the kidney itself, we call it autoregulation. It's just a way that the kidney autoregulates itself. Could you tell me the name of the autoregulation mechanism of the heart, which is the intrinsic one? Is what? The Frank Starling law of the heart, right? Which by end diastolic volume, as the heart stretches, it gets stronger, typically in a normal heart. Okay, so autoregulation is, or even extrinsic and intrinsic, are controlled by vasoconstriction or vasodilation of blood flow into the glomerulus, right? Because that's where filtration takes place. So if you increase the flow of blood into the glomerulus, you have increased filtration. If you decrease flow, you have decreased filtration. All right, so either vasoconstriction or dilation of the afferent arterioles affects blood flow and thus glomerular filtration ratio. So what can do that? Here is a figure that shows the extrinsic mechanism, okay? And it's due to the autonomic nervous system, in particular the sympathetic division right here. All right, so a decrease in blood pressure by the baroreceptor reflex. So where are pressure receptors located? Anybody remember where pressure receptors are located? In the aortic arch and the carotid sinus, right? Send signals, afferents to the vasomotor center in the medulla, okay? That then the vasomotor center is going to increase sympathetic tone or sympathetic nerve activity, okay? When blood pressure decreases, so what's it going to do? Send sympathetic, increase sympathetic tone to the heart, increase heart rate and heart contractility, so stroke volume goes up, heart rate goes up, which means what? Cardiac output goes up, so that means then blood pressure goes up. All right, sympathetic nerves can vasoconstrict the afferent arterioles in the kidney. So what happens to glomerular filtration when the afferent arterioles constrict? It goes down because it has less blood flow, so less urine is produced. What's the effect of producing less urine on blood volume? It increases, so blood volume increases, and what's the effect of increasing blood volume to this initial stimulus right here? It's going to subtract from it, because when you increase blood volume, because of Frank Starling law, the heart contracts a little bit stronger, right? So your blood pressure will increase, right? Also increasing sympathetic tone vasoconstricts blood vessels in the skin and gastrointestinal tract, and then increases total peripheral resistance, or TPR. And remember that equation we had on the board? Well, how is blood pressure related to what? Total peripheral resistance and stroke volume and heart rate. It's all directly related. So as total peripheral resistance increases, that does what? That increases blood pressure, and how does that relate to this initial stimulus? It subtracts from it. So it's another nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, so this is, why do we call this extrinsic? Because we see regulation of glomerular filtration rate due to receptors that are in arteries, right, due to the vasomotor center, which is in the medulla oblongata, which is outside the kidney, and the whole sympathetic outflow pathway, right, which is it's not in the kidney. So that's extrinsic to the kidney. So this is extrinsic control of glomerular filtration rate. All right, let's talk about the intrinsic mechanisms. And this is autoregulation on the heart. There are two. All right, so if autoregulation is just defined as the ability of the kidneys to maintain relatively constant glomerular filtration rate, even when blood pressure is going up and down. All right, so it's very important for the kidneys to be operating all the time. And if they stop operating because of decreased blood flow, guess what happens to a kidney? It dies. Okay, so a kidney always has to be producing urine. It requires a lot of ATP, and it can get that from the oxygen that's being transported in the blood as well. All right, so blood pressure changes, GFR should not change very much. All right, so these autoregulation mechanisms will take care of that. There are two. There's something called the myogenic response, all right, and then there's something called tubuloglomerular feedback. All right, so that has to do with what? Some of the tubes of the nephron and the glomerulus. All right, so we'll take a look at these things. First, the myogenic constriction or myogenic response, and this happens in the afferent arteriole, okay, when there is an increase in blood pressure. So if your blood pressure goes up, all right, what's going to happen to flow through a tube as the pressure goes up? How is flow related to pressure? It's directly related. So if the pressure goes up, flow through the glomerulus goes up, GFR goes up, but what did we want to do? We want to maintain, constant GFR, right? So when blood pressure goes up, the flow through the glomerulus goes way up. All right, there's something else that happens to a blood pressure, to a blood vessel when pressure goes up. So take a balloon, increase the pressure in a balloon, what happens to it? It starts to stretch, right? So there are stretch receptors in the afferent arteriole, and when they start to stretch, guess what those muscles do? They start to constrict, all right, back down to resist that stretching. And so if they stretch, you get increased blood flow, but when the smooth muscles start to constrict, what happens to blood flow? It goes back down to where it was before blood pressure went back up. All right, so myogenic response is a way to increase or decrease vasoconstriction of the afferent arteriole to maintain GFR at the same rate because it's going to regulate flow through the glomerulus. All right, and that is intrinsic, that's autoregulation. Tubuloglomerular feedback is something that happens, right, due to locally produced chemicals on the afferent arteriole, and that's due to a structure that maybe you saw in anatomy. It's called the juxtaglomerular apparatus. That's a place where the distal convoluted tubule, this diagram isn't exactly right, it was just easy to draw, where the distal convoluted tubule actually passes right between the afferent and efferent arteriole on its way to the collecting duct. And there's a special little structure right there called the juxtaglomerular apparatus. So we're going to take a look at that in a little bit. But here is a table, all right, that actually outlines the three things that we've talked about so far. Sympathetic nerves, right, via the baroreceptor reflex can decrease GFR by causing vasoconstriction. All right, so what kind of control is that? Is that intrinsic or extrinsic? That's extrinsic, right? So there's that extrinsic control. And then we have these two auto-regulation mechanisms. A decrease in blood pressure is going to do what to the afferent arteriole? Decrease blood pressure, what happens to blood flow through the glomerulus if you decrease blood pressure? It decreases, but we want to keep GFR the same. So how do you maintain blood flow when blood pressure decreases? Dilate the blood vessel, right? So that dilates the blood vessel, thereby doesn't cause a decrease in GFR, right? That's autoregulation. That's just a myogenic response of those smooth muscle cells. Conversely, if there's an increase in blood pressure, what are the smooth muscles of the afferent arteriole going to do? They're going to constrict because an increase in blood pressure is going to force a lot more blood through the glomerulus. That's going to increase GFR, but we don't want to increase GFR. So those smooth muscles constrict, reducing blood flow through the glomerulus so that GFR does not change. All right, so this is what we call the myogenic response, and we see autoregulation, but what is that really, intrinsic or extrinsic? That's intrinsic. That's just a property of the kidney by itself. Dang, we'll have to talk about this next time. All right, so the other part to what? An intrinsic mechanism is tubuloglomerular feedback, and so that's where we're going to start next time. And that has to do with what? The juxtaglomerular apparatus. All right, sign-in sheet is going around somewhere.